Well, hello everyone. If you walk up to most people and ask them, tell me one thing you know about Joseph Stalin, they'll probably say, well, he was a horrific monster who ran a totalitarian state of bread lines and gulags. But since I've started researching this topic, and I've done several previous videos on this, which I recommend you check out, I've become increasingly interested in whether this is the whole story. You see these incredible claims, like the title of this video, about an 850% increase in steel production. And you know, on the face of it, you think, well, this sounds absurd. It sounds like propaganda. How can anybody achieve an 850% increase in steel production? But then you start digging into the numbers, and even if they're not quite always what the Soviets claimed, in many cases they were, by the way, they're still pretty staggering. Now, to tell you, that number, the 850% increase, steel production in 1928, around about the time when Stalin was consolidating his power, was about 4 million tons. By 1953, towards the end of Stalin's time in power, steel production was 38 million tons. So that's an 850% increase. That's where I'm getting this figure from. But this figure of massive increase in steel production you can take as a proxy measure for the success of the rapid industrialization under Stalin, which is something I'm very interested in. I'm also particularly interested in the cope of people, critics of socialism, Westerners in general, who just want to do whatever possible to deny Stalin the credit for these achievements. And such as the demonization of Stalin, nobody can give him credit for, you know, let's say the 850% increase in steel production. They want to attribute it to other factors. They want to, you know, they want to say, oh, well, there was land lease, there was outside help, there was all this, you know, they try to explain it away. But I've been looking into this, and the more I look into it, you can't really explain it away. Just give you some of my sources before I continue. There's Was Stalin Really Necessary by Alex Nove, right? By no means a communist source. It's not that biased. Yeah, in fact, in some places it's critical of Stalin. But some of the things it discusses in there, figures, the decision-making, cannot really be disputed. Even more important is this book by Paul R. Gregory, The Political Economy of Stalinism, which is full of fascinating little, it's got lots of details of the five-year plan and, graphs and all sorts of things in here. The target versus the actuals in terms of the five-year plans. Here it's got, you know, investment goals, actual amounts of money allocated by Stalin to various parts of the economy. It's got things like this as well, where, say, in 1951, the Politburo drew up various plans for Gosplan, for the five-year plan, and Stalin, in the margins, corrected or adjusted the percentages. One of the things that you get from this book is that Stalin was incredibly hands-on. That is, when people use labels like dictator, which I know Grover Fur, who I talked to, doesn't like as a label, actually, what this was a lot of the time is that a lot of the underlings, a lot of the other members of the Politburo, had a habit of deferring decisions up the tree to Stalin. And it actually created something of a bottleneck, and it was a frustration to Stalin. He used to get very irritated by it because it was like everything from, you know, ratifying or, you know, having the final kind of sign-off on something as important as the five-year plan down to, oh, what colour should the signs be at the Moscow parade and things like this. There are letters that I've got in other books here where Stalin is visibly kind of irritated. Why are you bothering me with this? I'm really, really busy. Another thing that this book has somewhere is simply the amount of time that Stalin spent in one-on-one meetings with the other Politburo members. And, I mean, you can see he barely had a spare hour in his day. Like, he literally was working, you know, 18, 19-hour days, 20-hour days in some cases. It's kind of crazy. But it also created a decision bottleneck because people kept on passing the buck up the chain. So it ended up, Stalin ended up deciding a lot of things on his own, which is not actually that efficient in terms of just getting stuff done, which is why Stalin got frustrated with it. There was a kind of bureaucratic bottleneck. But anyway, the point is that these aren't necessarily biased or like pro-Stalin sources. These are just the facts, okay? So in this video, I'm going to look at how Stalin achieved this massive increase in industrial production output. Before I get going, though, do pick up courses at the Academic Agency, Foundations of Economics, Foundations of Politics, Foundations of Shakespeare. Trivium is the bestseller. Pick up my brand new book, Applied Elite Theory, as well, if you'd like. Many great things to get. But let's get back to the lecture at hand here, which is, how did the Soviet Union pull off this extraordinary industrial transformation that its rivals took a lot longer to achieve? Stalin did in 10, 15 years what it had taken Britain and America over 100, 200 years to, and he seemed to do it, almost overnight. And more importantly, why is the standard narrative so often focused on just one part of the picture, namely Stalin is a bad guy, Stalin is evil, blah, blah, blah? Why is it only focused on that? Why does it not focus on the extraordinary and rapid industrialization process that we saw? Okay, and this is what I am particularly interested in, because to me, it's almost miraculous what, if you look on paper what they did in the space of just a few years, we should be asking what happened there. So, to get your head around this explosion of industry, you first have to understand the absolute mess that the country was in from the moment that the Bolsheviks took over. In the early 20th century, Russia was a vast agrarian empire, basically shackled by feudal or semi-feudal traditions. You had peasants working the land with tools their ancestors would have recognized. That is, you basically had people working, might as well have been like 16th or 17th century peasants, okay, by Western standards. Then the First World War bled the nation dry. The monarchy, that is the Tsar, collapsed, and it followed years of brutal civil war. The Reds versus the Whites, some of the horrors that Trotsky presided over in charge of the Red Army. So that all happened. By the time the Bolsheviks were actually in charge, the country was in ruins. Right, the cost of the civil... Okay, you're just coming off World War One, then you have a civil war. Okay, that is a very rocky start for Lenin. Okay, and Lenin, in fact, has a nervous breakdown because the pressure on him is so intense. And this comes across if you read Molotov Remembers and some of the first-hand accounts of Lenin during that period. He was under a lot of pressure. The comrades were bickering between themselves, and he was just thinking, "What do I? I need to make sure this works. What needs to be done? How am I going to stop Russia from collapsing?" And not only if this revolution fails, it'll basically like destroy communism. It'll destroy us, our legacy and history, and all that sort of stuff. So he's thinking all the time in those terms. Meanwhile, you've got all of the other members of the Politburo are Bukharin wants to go one way, Trotsky wants to do another thing, Molotov and Stalin have their own ideas, and they're all arguing all the time. And Lenin, this is the early period of the Bolsheviks. Lenin's new economic policy, or the NEP, allowed a bit of private enterprise to come back. Okay, now that was absolutely necessary at that time, because if he hadn't done it, things would have collapsed. Okay, they needed to bring in outside managers. They needed to You know, they couldn't go too fast, too soon, in such dire circumstances. But the NEP, as you'll, if you understand the literature, was always meant to be a short-run, temporary thing, okay? And Lenin said that at the time. But it was required to stabilise things. Many in the party felt that this was a step backwards and a betrayal of communist ideals at the time. But it's important to understand that for Lenin and for Stalin later and for all Marxist-Leninists, first and foremost, they're pragmatists. What needs to be done? What needs to be done first? Then ideological purity spiraling second. That's an infant. In fact, that is an infantile disorder, according to Lenin. Right? Leftism is an infantile disorder. He has to live in the real world as the actual leader. So, you know, it wasn't really a betrayal, because if he hadn't have done it, things would have collapsed. Stalin himself put it in these very stark terms in 1931. We are 50 or 100 years behind the advanced countries. We must make good this distance in 10 years. Either we do it or they will crush us. So you can see it wasn't just about economics. They saw it as a matter of pure survival. And once you start seeing Stalin and Lenin in these sorts of terms, as people in a real situation who had to make real decisions, okay, it becomes a lot less about theoretical debates and more a matter of pure, like, how do we make this work? How do we achieve our goals in a, it before the imperialist powers, before the West, destroys us? And they always had to think in those terms. The solution they had was something called revolution from above. Stalin's answer was radical and it was absolute. In 1928, he got rid of the NEP, the new economic policy, and launched what is called a revolution, or what he called revolution from above, the first five-year plan. This was the birth of the command economy, the command and control economy, which this book is all about, the command economy. Okay, basically, a central planning committee in Moscow was called Gosplan, and this would dictate every single aspect of production. They would set quotas, they would centrally set investment levels, and that was that big table I showed you, which was the central planning committee basically setting the amounts of money that each part of the economy would get. Okay, truly was centrally planned. No more market forces, no more private businesses. The state decided what got built, where it got built, how much was made. And the state decided to go all in on one thing above all else: heavy industry. While the Western nations were developing consumer goods alongside heavy industry, Stalin made the strategic, some might say the brutal, choice to concentrate on heavy industry, machinery, steel production, things like this. Okay. Now, what this meant was rationing in the consumer part in order to prioritize the manufacturing part. Okay. As an example, or the heavy industry part, I should say, not just manufacturing, heavy industry. So, as an example, one of the things that Stalin did is that he rationed clothing. Okay, a lot of the Russian peasantry, working class, proletariat, comrades, you could say, had to, you know, they were still making their own clothes. The state would kind of issue one pair of boots. There wasn't a choice. You got one pair of boots. Make them last. It was very much like that. You have to make do with these sacrifices on the personal level for the greater good of this project working. Okay, not going to pretend it wasn't hard. It was. That changed, as we'll see, that changed later on. When Khrushchev came in, he was like, oh, tell you what, here's a whole range of different shoes. And if you're a woman, well, how about some stilettos? And, you know, let's try to ape the Western consumer choice model. That's what Khrushchev started to do when he came in. But Stalin, he understood where they were in history, where they were, in relative to the advanced economies of the West. they weren't in a position to say, like, comrade, how many different boots do you want? They were just coming out of feudalism. So he was like, look, we need to make sure that we have the infrastructure in place. The base of the economy needs to be in place first. Can't be pissing about with pink boots. You think I'm joking? This is actually the decisions that were made. In that first five-year plan of Stalin's, a staggering 86% of all industrial investment was poured into things like coal, iron and steel, especially steel. Things like clothes and housing were an afterthought. The goal was to build the machines. And build the machines that build the machines. It was a monumental gamble to create an entire industrial base from nothing at any cost. And he was willing to make huge sacrifices to do it. And not always making the most popular choice. Because it's easy to say, well, I tell you what, let's try to just please the people, okay? But he knew that if he just like, all right, well, let's put everything into making consumer goods, you can't build an economy on that. You can't build a powerhouse, a superpower, on clothes. Or on choices of chocolate bar. Like I was talking about in some previous videos recently, he was trying to build up that productive base. The ambition of these five-year plans is quite hard to grasp when you look at the actual project, okay? Think about where they were starting and what Stalin was trying to achieve here, okay? The most famous of these was the magnetic mountain city, Maginogorska. This is why I've had to write these things down, okay? Maginogorska. Sorry about my Russian pronunciation, friends, okay? In 1929, it was just an iron-rich mountain out in the desolate Ural steppes. 3 years later, it was on its way to becoming one of the largest steel plants the world has ever seen. Tens of thousands of workers, many of them peasants who'd never even set foot in a factory, were sent there to build this city of steel from the frozen ground up. Okay? Think about the hard work and the sacrifice and the blood and the tears and the salt and the sweat that it takes to create something like that from scratch. And this was all driven by a machine that sold their work as a heroic battle for socialism. But you can say, well, that's propaganda. It is kind of heroic, isn't it? Think about it. They were literally carving this new city out of the rock with their bare hands. And Stalin needed to motivate them. He needed to find ways to make people want to do this. And there's an idea that he just did it with a gun to the back of the head. That is not strictly speaking true. You can't make the entire system work just, you know, with the boot and the gun. His messaging in many places was quite successful. He had to appeal to different things, national solidarity and all sorts of other things. And he actually allowed a few little folk customs and traditions and things to come back in after the excesses of the early Bolshevik period. He was quite deft at getting, you know, these tens of thousands of people to build this new city. And here's the fascinating paradox, and this is what I kind of find so interesting looking into this stuff. This wasn't just a story of brute force. Despite all of the ideological opposition in the West, the Soviet Union imported the best technology and experts the money could buy. Hundreds of American engineers and architects were hired to design and oversee these new industrial giants, these new massive projects he was doing everywhere. He needed expertise. And Stalin, being a pragmatist, being a realist, were like, well, we don't know how to do this. Let's get in some American engineers. They're looking for work. It was the Great Depression. America was in an unemployment crisis in the 1930s. So it was actually a great strategy for Stalin to bring in Americans who knew how to do this stuff. The massive Dnieper hydroelectric station, one of the largest in the world at the time, was built using American turbines from General Electric. So you have this supposedly self-sufficient socialist state leveraging capitalist expertise to build its future. And they weren't just building factories, but symbols for a new era forged in ice and fire. Now, I don't want to pause here because the fact that Stalin had to bring in American experts or import American tech is often used as the gotcha. Oh, they didn't really achieve anything. They didn't really achieve anything because they had to import experts or they had to import tech. To me, this is a really childish argument. Okay, it's childish. Think about where they're coming from. They're coming from a near-medieval base, okay, as we've just talked about. They don't have the knowledge and the expertise. They're literally peasants. How are they going to do it? Of course they're going to import it. But that's how tech always works. Every people who is teching up or playing catch-up has to import something from somewhere else. Even the British, if you have a look, I mean, the British invented lots of stuff on their own, the British Empire did. But even they were famous. If they saw a good idea, if they saw a bit of innovation, they'd take that, they'd import it in. That was always sold as the great advantage of the pragmatic Brits, who were able to just see a good idea. All right, if that works, if that way of doing it works in India, we'll bring it over here. Or, I mean, famously, they looked at how the Chinese made tea, and they were like, right, we don't really want to import the Chinese tea, right? Because we've already had that problem with it. So let's just take what they're doing there, and we'll bring that to India, and we'll create tea industry there in India. Nobody says, oh yeah, well, the British just stole that tech. You know, because they were innovative. You have to take ideas from elsewhere. Or if you have a look at in the American case. In America, in the 19th century, America was in the catch-up mode. And they brought a lot of British engineers, British manufacturing, British machines, British rail workers in the 19th century to help build up American industry in that decade. And of course they looked to Britain because Britain was the tech leader at that time. Or if you'd have a look at Japan after World War II, they were playing catch up. They brought in a lot of different tech from different places, especially from the West. Okay, but then they made it work in their own terms. So it's childish. It's a childish argument to say that because Stalin had the idea that, well, we'll bring in the people who know how to do this. Smart. But because he had that idea, therefore, actually, the success of this was down to America, not down to Stalin. Actually, nobody can read this book and say it wasn't down to Stalin. It absolutely was down to the central decision maker who made everything tick. Down to the level of what percentage each output should be. Down to the investment costs, down to the decimal point, Stalin cast his eye over it. So why do people try to deny this? Why do they cope? Oh yeah, but at some point they had help from Wall Street. Who cares? It doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if they had help here and there, or if they didn't know how to do this bit, or they didn't know how to do that bit. The fact is, they started from a place of nothing, and they carved a city out of an ice mountain. They started from an agricultural base, and they turned the Soviet Union into an industrial powerhouse and superpower in the entire world, the number two power in the world. Got up into space by the 1950s. Medieval peasants at the start of the century, space by the 50s. Are you kidding me? So, like, trying to take these things away from them is childish. And is the sort of thing that really irritates me, because people just lack the ability just to tell the truth. Just to tell the truth. And it's not an ideological thing. You don't have to be a Marxist or a communist to believe these. It's just facts. The numbers don't lie. So let's carry on. Did the gamble for Stalin pay off? The official Soviet statistics are breathtaking. Between 1928 and 1940, overall industrial production grew by over 850%. On the face of it, you think it can't be right. But the proof is in the pudding. Those factories were there. That steel output was there. Those cities are still there now. The oil and the gas industry still exist now. They were built by Stalin. It's not propaganda. It exists. It is literally there. So when critics dismiss these figures as mere propaganda, well, let's go back to Carlisle. Just look with your own eyes. It existed. People basically point to factory managers being under immense pressure. Okay, so they say, well, they set these quotas and people were so scared not to hit them. They just lied about their numbers. But actually, I've had a look here, and it's not always the case, you know. It's not always the case. Sometimes they were under target, and sometimes they were over target. And it doesn't say that if you're under target that, you know, you just get killed, which is the kind of cartoon idea. You can have a look here in the first quarter of 1982. Molotov Commission had a delivery plan, you can see here, and then there were actual deliveries. Now, some of them hit, some of them were over, some of them were significantly under. I noticed the that Moscow region was under. They had a target of 8, they hit under by 5. Ukraine region at a target of 2 and overhit by 8. So it's not always the case. Like, sometimes they hit their targets, sometimes they didn't hit their targets. It's not, I mean, the cartoon is, if you didn't hit your target, Stalin would kill you. But that is just not viewed, that is not seen. The, you can have a look at my previous videos on the purges and the Moscow trials and things like that. So let's carry on. Independent Western analyses, okay, suggest that overall growth was a remarkable 260%. Okay, so the steel production was 850%, but the overall growth, and this is independent Western analyses, was about 260% growth. Getting bogged down in debate over the exact percentage misses the forest for the trees. Okay, when we hone in on steel, at the heart of the revolution, the figures are dramatic, as I've talked about. Okay, from 4 million in 1927-28 to 18 million tons in 1937 is a 350% increase. And then by 1953, as I talked about, we're up to 38 million tons, which is actually an 850% increase. What I'm trying to say is here, whatever the real figures are, even the most conservative estimates by Western economists, kind of hostile to the Soviet Union, confirm that a monumental leap did take place during this period. By the end of the 1930s, the Soviet Union had surpassed Germany and Britain to become the second largest industrial power in the world, behind only the United States. Considering the head start Britain had with the British Empire, you know, controlling a fifth of world assets at that time, maybe even more, it's a remarkable achievement, unprecedented. The head start America had as well. It's to deny this achievement is to deny reality. So then you have to ask, how is all of this even possible? How did they even manage it? And the official story is one of heroic revolutionary fervour. That comes across in some of the books. The Stalin Era by Anna Louise Strong has that kind of narrative, the heroic revolutionary fervour. And for many, that was true. State propaganda was everywhere, celebrating workers who blew past their quotas. The imagery was heroic and muscular. It was kind of like muscular Marxist-Leninism, basically. They created a new class of celebrity workers, rewarding them with better pay. housing, for shattering production records. You could even be like, oh yeah, I was the guy in, like, you know, 1938 who, you know, I was 20% over my quote. Like, it would actually make you like a little, they'd celebrate it on a local level. Millions of young people genuinely caught up in the promise of building the world's first socialist society volunteered for these massive projects. Obviously, this is only half of the story, of course. There was coercion. I'm not going to pretend there wasn't coercion. The state imposed incredibly strict labour discipline. Being late or absent could get you treated as a criminal, sent to Gulag. To get workers for the new factories, millions of peasants were forced off their land through violent collectivisation policies. You know, they had the policy of liquidating the kulaks. The Holodomor, which I talked about in previous videos, partly was caused by the revolt against those policies, because the kulaks destroyed all of their machinery and they killed all of their livestock, which led to, which actually exacerbated an already low grain yield for that year, which then resulted in a bigger famine. That is the what actually happened, as far as I can work out. And so, you know, I'm not going to say there wasn't brutality, because there absolutely was. But you can't argue with the results, okay? You can't argue with the results. Also, I mean, we can talk about the gulag and prison labour and so on. But as Grover Fuhr talked about when I interviewed him, the gulag was actually, like, the conditions there were not a million miles away from conditions in British prisons or American prisons or French prisons in that era, right? You always remember Thomas Sowell, compared to what? Well, the gulag in its context was not that. I mean, in America you had the chain gangs and things like that. Nobody really talks about them as a gulag, right? Because there isn't, you know, there isn't the kind of vested ideological purpose for that. But a lot of countries used prison labour at this time. So, was it all worth it? It brings us to one of the great questions of Western history. What was the human cost? The drive for industrialisation was directly linked to one of the greatest tragedies, the man-made famines of the Holodomor, like I talked about. But as I mentioned just now, this was not deliberate, but it's not like they set out to deliberately kill all of these people. It was a byproduct of trying to force collectivisation and seizing the grain there and seizing the means of production, and the revolt of the kulaks basically caused that to happen. And obviously in that period there in the early 30s, life for the average person was hard. And even if you were a fully paid up comrade, if you were fully invested in the revolution, a lot of this was hard work. Like, even if you were just not even if you were a gulag guy, if you were just working on one of these massive projects, it was tough. You know, you didn't have the consumer luxuries that people would be used to now. So from a purely humanitarian perspective, you could say that, you know, the costs were significant. But from the cold, strategic viewpoint of, did the trade-off make it worth it? You could argue that now you've got an powerful industrial base that now exists. It didn't exist before. The Soviet Union is a superpower, not defenseless. Now it can't be crushed by hostile capitalist powers. They won World War II, don't forget. And so you could say that he was vindicated by his, I mean, look at Russia today. Putin in Russia would not be able to hold his own against the entirety of NATO had it not been for the sacrifices made by the people in the Stalin era. They built that country. It was hard. It was really hard. But you've got to, in a way, not view it through a liberal lens. You have to view it through the lens of the collective national struggle to achieve something bigger than yourself. This uncomfortable truth, I think, is often ignored. The industrial base, built on the bones of peasants in the 30s, is precisely what allowed the Soviet Union to exist. Ultimately, the defeat of Nazi Germany in the Second World War, the factories were built in the Urals, far from the front lines. They churned out T-34 tanks, military hardware that overwhelmed the German war machine. Without the superior steel production, there is no victory at Stalingrad. Without the industrial might forged in the five-year plans, the history of the 20th century would have looked very different. So it forces us to confront some uncomfortable truths. And also, if now, you know, like when you really think about it, you say, well, okay, Stalin built up this superpower on the bones of the peasants. But then if you think about the British Empire, I think back to the 2012 Olympics, where you've got the kind of capitalists and the, you know, the fat cats there, you know, ordering the peasants about, bone, you know, backbreaking labour of the working class of Britain. They also built this country. They also built this country. British Empire was built on the backs of the bones of the peasants. It's just that Stalin did it a little bit later and with an accelerated timeline. In the end, the story of Stalin's industrial drive is a testament to what a nation can achieve when mobilized towards a single monumental goal. Unprecedented economic growth laid the foundation for a new global superpower. To focus only on certain narratives copes, right, while ignoring the colossal industrial leap that reshaped the global balance of power, is, in my view, a disservice to history. Childish way of viewing history. Adult way of viewing history is to take the rough with the smooth, take the smooth with the rough. Not only focusing on the rough. What was actually achieved there? You're looking at an incomplete picture. You can't understand Soviet victory in World War II or the Cold War without understanding the five-year plans, why they're a success. While some of you want to remember only the struggles, to understand the 20th century, you have to remember the steel. You have to see the power that steel production created. And you have to ask yourself, why is this incredible achievement so often overlooked? All right, folks, pick up my book, Applied Elite Theory. Pick up courses at the Academic Agency, and I'll catch you next time. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.